Accession number 4662, room number 5.
Anderson Reel 5. Apart from the summer months in the hill stations, I believe you were also detached to various other places in India during your service there.
Yes, in a way, this is quite an interesting part about service with the Army Cooperation Squadron. As I've mentioned before, it's Army Cooperation, and this meant that we travelled all over India during the winter months. During the summer, of course, we're stationed at our base, Ambala, and as autumn approached, we moved to mainly to the southern half of India, say to Jhansi, Bangalore, or the southern part, where one was attached to various army units or brigades, where we did exercises. Now, the squadron was usually split into flights for this purpose, three flights to a squadron, and one flight to various or individual station wherever they wanted this cooperation, and that meant four aircraft and a rigger and fitter to each aircraft, the photographer to look after the photography side, two or three wireless operators would maintain the ground wireless station, be ground wireless operators, and one or two operators for the air work, and four aircraft. This meant probably about 12 or 13 airmen, one corporal and probably a flight sergeant, and that would be the airmen, and then four or five officers. Before aircraft, probably there'd be five officers would come with us, because army corporations didn't employ NCO pilots, because all the work was in connection with the army, and probably the army always treated NCO pilots with a little bit of suspicion or a little bit thought they weren't quite up to standard officer pilots, whereas we always thought it was the reverse. But anyhow, the bomber squadrons on the Northwest Frontier, of course, probably 50-50 NCO pilots and officer pilots. And another one occasion, Northwest Frontier, they had a sergeant who was leading a flypast. He was so experienced that he was leading the whole squadron in a flypast. So the CO could stand on the ground and watch his squadron perform. And he said he was expected the best part to lead them. And that was an NCO pilot. So they were quite a high standard, just equal to officer pilots, I should say. It's just a matter of training, isn't it? And not ranked so much, or what college one went to. Anyway, I say this advantage of travelling. For example, we went to Jhansi, which is, they call it the centre of India, perhaps the centre of India, to a place there where we struck up camp. We arrived at these places. There's usually Indian service corps people waiting for us with mule carts for our luggage, if we've got a lot of luggage. But we mostly went self-sufficient in a way. We'd have special coaches and trucks for us, and we'd drive our general runabout tender, towing a water cart. We've always got our water, carried our water with us, or filled it from various sources at the other end, a water cart, and probably all our stores. We carry a spare propeller, all nuts and bolts, kite coil, all sorts of odds and ends you want for daily maintenance of aircraft. If you want an engine, we had a send that came from the depot. We shouldn't need an engine at any time, but we didn't carry a spare engine. But there's quite a lot of gear. Probably have four trucks full of gear and one coach. I never know how, of course, the officers flew the aircraft, so usually we weren't supervised by an officer. We went on these trips to these places, entirely on our own initiative. Probably the flight sergeant would be with us, or he may even fly with the flight. But there would be at least a corporal with us.
I believe in one of these occasions you had rather interesting experience with the Proclamation Day parade.
Yes, this was one where we were going to Secunderabad. That's in smaller central India again, and this we left Ambala with all our trucks and things and our gear and our coach. We took our food for a few days. We clubbed together, put in the pool, buy bully beef, buy tin fruit, so we have something to eat on the way and haven't got to rely on anybody else, because we get pushed in sidings anywhere on these four trucks going along and one coach. But it's quite an experience. I used to enjoy it. We used to get very dirty with the dust and such like. By the time we got the other end, our uniforms were filthy after 4 days. And we weren't unduly worried. Water usually ran out because they couldn't have a wash or a shower, probably the last day. But anyway, we left Umballa on one of these occasions. We had forgotten the date. It was end of December, I know. We travelled on. I think it was on the fourth day. I think we subsisted on bananas. I think we bought a railway station the last day of our journey. And we arrived at Secunderabad. And there was one lorry with an Indian driver and a few general service mule wagons, two-wheel wagons with two mules in it, one Indian driver. They're the transport used out throughout India for army moving, rather than motor vehicles or lorries. They go by these transport. We loaded up all this lot, because the Indian drivers, they don't load or unload. We do that ourselves. And we loaded up these GS wagons. We finished that, we got in our lorry and told the driver to carry on. And completely forgetting that, this was the 1st of January now, and Proclamation Day in India, if people don't know it, is that on the 1st of January is usually a big parade throughout India. Every station, every command, they've gone parade, and it's considered a very high-class sort of ceremonial parade. And the high spot of the parade is that whoever the parade commander or in charge of the parade or general officer commander will read out the proclamation that the king is emperor of India and the dominions. And that's just a reminder, I suppose, to all and sundry of who we are and what we're doing there. And anyway, this being the 1st of January, which had completely gone from our minds, we hadn't thought of this at all. We had probably forgotten the date. So we set off in our lorry. And of course, the Beam Proclamation Day and big parade, our Indian driver, in all his innocence, thought we were part of the parade, in spite of our filthy looking appearance, and drove us onto this parade ground at Secunderabad. The whole garrison was on parade. This was in 1930, I think, my second year in India, 1930. And the parade had just formed up. The bayonets were fixed, were glinting in the sun. All the British soldiers and Indian soldiers were impeccable in their khaki uniforms, nicely creased shorts, shiny boots, beautiful parade. It looked wonderful as we drove onto the parade ground. And we thought, this is funny, what are you doing here? And then the parade sergeant major, he came storming up. He could hardly speak. He was almost bursting. He said, "Who are you? What are you? Get off my parade ground." He was horrified. A scruffy looking lot of bandits had arrived on his parade ground in the middle of the parade, or just about the parade to commence. And he said, "Get off, get off." Of course, the poor Indian driver, he was flabbergasted. He turned turtle and he really drove fast, all in a cloud of dust behind him from his parade ground. So that was our proclamation day. Of course, then we realized it, and then we tried to explain to the driver, "Go to the airfield. We're not part of the parade." Oh, it suddenly dawned upon him then. Yes, parade, the airfield. Of course, then he took us out to this isolated spot, which we were to stay for the exercises with the army. Wasn't a very positive beginning, but we heard no more about it. I suppose, obviously, it was an accident. I don't know if the engine driver got in the hot water bed. I don't know, but we heard no more about it.
And I believe you were also posted to the Northwest Frontier for a while.
Yes, that was towards the end of that year. We had finished our winter with the army, and it was just towards the end of end of that year, 1930. It must have been towards the end of the year. We had orders to proceed to the Northwest Frontier because the bomber squadrons there were feeling the strain of continuous operations for quite a long time, with the uprising of the Momans, I think, and the Afridis. Momans at that time, when we got there, Afridis had settled down a little bit, but both were still fairly active. And we went up there to help with the reconnaissance, not with the active bombing and anything like that, because we were light aircraft, and amongst those enormous mountains, when one flew over that, as far as I could see, these enormous, almost, well, it was barren at the time, probably before the monsoon, not much cultivation, And of course, they're not cultivated at the peaks, they're very stony on the valleys are cultivated. But you see miles and nothing up these great big peaks. We used to fly our little aircraft amongst these peaks and just report any unusual gathering of the Indians down below, the Pathans, or they may be, or they're all Pathans really, but they're various tribes, our Afridis, Mormons, any gathering which we treated with suspicion. And then if you want any dispersal, then a bomber squadron did that. But usually the policy was to not to injure people, but to warn them and carry out reprisals by give them notice that we're going to bomb your village because you're not behaving, you're fighting somebody else, you're raiding their village for food, you mustn't do that. And to show that we are displeased, we're going to bomb your village in 48 hours' time. So the next 48 hours, all getting all their goods and chattels out there, all their huts, stone huts in the hills, because they know that we mean it, we are going to destroy their village. So then they all sit round the hillside while the bomber squadrons come and blow all the houses to pieces. And that keeps them quiet for the next couple of months while they rebuild their village again. It doesn't take long, I don't think, and not much damage is done. And sometimes we do threaten to bomb their crops, but that's seldom done. Yeah, that brings probably too much hardship, and that will only aggravate the trouble because they're raiding their neighbours for crops or cattle or something like that. So it's mainly just a warning showing that we can do. And the whole, it's quite dangerous work to get fairly low amongst those hills. One or two aircraft were lost, either shot down or either crippled and that had come back with flattering engines back to base, or just probably flew into the hills, catch a wingtip in the hills, and then, of course, that's goodbye. But I know one occasion, one pilot was even killed. He was shot flying over an earthquake. It was one in a million chance of a bullet killing a pilot. He was killed. And the air gunner, in the properties they had, you could put a control column into a socket on one side of the cockpit, which controlled the fore and aft movement, and they also had a rudder bar underneath the pilot's seat, so we had a backward, you could turn an aircraft, you could throttle back the engine from the rear cockpit, but very few. I know about one of my pilots tried to teach me a little bit of flying, but with no communication, it was practically impossible for flying, unless you knew how to theory of flying of an aeroplane. But this air gunner, he brought the aeroplane right back to his base, all right. And unfortunately, in landing, of course, all aeroplanes were a little difficult to be fairly precise in landing. He bounced a bit too much, the tail bounced, and it flipped over on its back. And the air gunner had his back broken or his neck broken and killed him as he landed. Of course, which is hard luck, of course. Got no recognition for his flying achievement. Because there was no such thing as an award after death for any flying. You've got to survive a flying incident to get an award for it. Like VC, you can be awarded after you kill if you're killed in action. But a flying award, of course, there's no such thing post-mortem, whatever it is, after death. So you got no recognition except commendation, I suppose, and orders. But it could be done with a little bit more training. Probably would have landed it all right. That's one, just by the way, what could happen. We used to fly over there on reconnaissance, reporting back. But it fairly quietened down the northwest frontier, but it was coal work, flying high altitudes and very bumpy up the hills. It was really bumpy. It's the only time I ever really felt ill in an aircraft. I was trying to communicate with my base. We had used Morse code, trying to communicate. This thing bouncing about and tapping on the key. It's very difficult, really, and I really felt ill on one occasion. The thing an air gunner daren't be. He'd be disgraced for if he was sick.
You mentioned the Westland Wapiti. I believe your squadron was re-equipped with these in 1931.
Yes, after our return from the northwest frontier, we returned to our base at Umballa, and here we were re-equipped with Wapitis. Slight modification on the bomber squadrons, probably not much, but for army cooperation work, again, the only real difference was, I suppose, we had a hook for message picking up. We still carried out message picking up with Wapitis. And they were a much more comfortable aircraft to fly. They were much larger, more room in the rear cockpit. But again, we had difficulties with communication with powers. No such thing as intercommunication gear. So when you learn to fly, or the old system was just speaking tubes, a plain tube was quite all right to speak through. I know one pilot had a tube rigged up, and I think I have out of an oil can as a speaking, as a microphone, or not, as a speaking part, and to his air gun at the back. But he only just could hear, it wasn't very clear. But he experimented, making his own communication. So it was difficult. I know one pilot tried to teach me a little bit about flying, because I said they had a stick and rudder bar in rear of those cockpits, and I found that every time I start turning, the nose drops, and I didn't have to keep the nose up. I pulled the stick back, which is the wrong thing to do. You use rudder to keep the nose up, strange to say. Of course, I never knew anything about opposite rudder through the way you were turning, that sort of fine art of flying. So, but they used to say, oh, Dacre, fine, straight. It was quite simple, and doing a sort of skidding turn just with the rudder, that was all right, but doing a bank turn without proper instruction or without instructor was practically impossible. Probably if you told me on the ground how to do it, probably it would have been all right, but I just didn't know the art of what we call top rudder. So, say, there's much more room, and it was easier for using the rear gun too, because you had firing steps. There's two steps along each side of the cockpit. You stood up on those, and therefore you came high up the cockpit. And your seat just fitted into a curved portion of the rear of the gun ring, so you shoved it round with your rear, or helped it round instead of putting it with your arms. You could push it round with your body, more or less, because the rest of the body from waist up was, of course, out in the slipstream. But it had more room for fitting the wireless sets. And but we got nothing new all the time I was out there. We're still using the same ones the time I left India, still using the ones first went there, most of them all outdated, and difficult to keep going the whole time. But I think we did get new type generators, by the time I arrived, we got new type sets of generators with wind driven put on the wings. They were a slight improvement. But on the whole, we were pleased to get Wapitis, because Bristol fighters didn't have all that power, and we liked flying in the Wapitis. It's quieter too somehow, because the engine was well in front, and on the whole there was little difference in our work. We still carried out the same exercises as we did in the Bristol fighters, but we had longer range, we stayed up in the air longer. So for example, one day on the artillery shoot, I think I was about 4 hours in the rear cockpit over a battery doing an artillery shoot. It was down at Jhansi, another time at Jhansi. And these detachments away were always something to look forward to. It broke the sort of monotony of living in one station, though it wasn't monotonous really, plenty of sport, plenty of work, but it made that break of seeing something entirely different. And we'd rather go away on our winter exercise in southern India, because we had a continuous summer. We felt quite sorry if we had to go back to our unit to spend Christmas at our unit, because it'd be the winter monsoon to set in by that time. It'd be rainy. It wouldn't be the heavy rain of the summer months, it would be rainy, it would be cold, the billets would get damp, the roofs leak very badly, the beds would be all over the place, the floor would be damp, we put our wash bowls on the floor to catch the drips, and you had fire if you could go and collect wood from somewhere, if you've got an old prop or somewhere, you cut up and have a fire one night, but you had to find your own fuel if you wanted a fire. We did have fireplaces in these bungalows, but no official fuel allowance, you have to scrounge it for yourself, and trees are very scarce. I mean, the Indians had to burn cow dung, so they can manure in their fields with cow dung. They dried it in the sun for fuel for their fires one evening to cook their food. In any Indian village of a night, dusk, especially in a calm Indian evening, you see a smoke haze all over the village, everybody burning their fires, cooking their evening meal. And it's going to be quite a pleasant sort of smell of coming out of burning, sort of burning, just like burning wood, really, which can be quite pleasant to smell in a way. And so we rather preferred travelling around southern India with the army, and the work was similar to our training. We spotted for, instead of doing imitation shoots, we did live shoots for the artillery. We had live message dropping, because the army were on manoeuvres. It was serious. We weren't just playing. We were taking part in important manoeuvres, so it wasn't just training. And I know one time, as I say, we talked about measures picking up. we swoop down on to pick up a message. On one occasion, we were on detachment somewhere, I can't remember which particular place, I was the man in the rear. We swooped down to get the message, the ground strips put out to pick up a message. So we swooped down to pick up the message, I lowered the hook from the rear cockpit. And for some reason, probably the ground was hard, the poles wouldn't stand up, a slight tug on the string across the poles, knocked the poles down. We had three attempts to pick this message up, and we just couldn't, the poles fell over, either slipstream, aeroplane, or whatever it was, the poles fell over each time, we failed to pick it up. We came round for the fourth time, much to my amazement, I saw two soldiers, Indian soldiers, standing very smartly at attention, with their rifles reversed, the butts up in the air, with a message strung across between them, because in the Lee Enfield rifles, I don't know about modern rifles, you had a little catch in the bottom, you could pull that catch up, and came up to a vertical position, inside was a coil of rope I pulled through with a brass weight on the end, and a loop on the other, pulling our flannel through the bore, and a canister of oil, a little tube of oil, we went into the butt of the rifle, and they just put these two hinged lids up, stood up vertically, and looped the string around these two catches, of lids, and they were standing perfectly to attention, and we flew down between them, with wing tips only just above the heads of that, and they didn't budge an inch, they just stood stolidly to attention, I flew, and we picked the message up. I thought, good God, you know, Indian soldier discipline, probably never seen an aeroplane before, let alone get one come so close, the noise, the wind stream must have been terrific. You know, I've been very nervous myself, I'd stand there, even if I knew the pilot and his abilities. But probably ignorance probably helped them rather than the knowledge. Anyway, I thought they were very, very brave men, well disciplined to do it. And it's always interesting working with the army. Used to follow columns of troops with close reconnaissance with the RT. And of course, also our own BIOS operators would be attached to the army, either with a battery or with an artillery brigade. They'd be out there. Receiving the messages from the aircraft, and also on following the RT set around, passing the messages by RT, which the army officer didn't touch on the ground. It was beyond their mobile, they wouldn't know how to handle it. And you had to write down the message and pass it to whoever was the runner or the officer concerned. So we enjoyed, I used to enjoy going down, because we live under canvas all the time. On our detachments, you know, never in a permanent building, always arrived there, but it's quite good. If you arrived there, nothing had happened in next no time. Long be the Indian Army Service Corps with all the tents, and they'd put them up for us. We never had to put our tents up. I think on one occasion we had to dismantle, but that was very rare. But the Army Service Corps, they were quite good, and sometimes they supplied us with beds. But if they didn't, we bought our Indian charpoys, the bamboo beds with the string stretched across them. We should put our biscuits on those, and it's quite a comfortable bed. I like the charpoys, they were very good indeed. And you took our mosquito nets as well, of course, keep flies away. If we had an afternoon off or a relaxing period, it was nice to put a mosquito net over, keep the flies away. It was quite interesting. And of course, another point about travel in India, which seems very strange now. You always carried your bedding wherever you went, besides rifle and 50 rounds of ammunition. Wherever you went, if you're going to be away at night, you took your bed with you. And that was a sort of carpet, a piece of carpet the size of a bed, a dori they called it. And you had a thick leather strap with a buckle on the end. And in this dori, one put your bedding. You took all the coir out your biscuits, so you get coir at the other end, probably. So you emptied your biscuits at the end of the bungalow. From there, if anybody else wanted to use it, they'd be able to use it again. And folded your biscuits up, which are just covers, and put those in the dory. And your wash hand basin. You always took your wash hand basin with you, otherwise there'd be nowhere to wash. I've got a photograph where I've got my wash basin stuck on three tent pegs. So it'd be a little elevated a little bit, so I could wash quite well outside my tent. And you always carried your enamel mug and your tin plate, knife, fork and spoon, all went into the door, and you rolled that into a roll. So you always had your bedding, something to eat from and wash from in your kit and your rifle and ammunition. And also when you went to put attachment to the army, like to the gun limbers or with the infantry, one took one duri, one's bedding, so you'd have a bed, so the army wouldn't have to spy you with a bed at all. It's quite an interesting point of travel in India. You've always had your bed with you. So if you stay at the railway station all night, you just unroll your bit of carpet and step on the railway platform, which I've done many a time in travel in India. Trains are uncertain or the connection was wrong. Oh well, the sleep, the only thing one got worried about, anybody, your rifle, you step that well tucked into you and the sling wrapped your arm around your arm a couple of times. The only thing that worried you, the sleeping part was no worry. I managed that all right.
In 1932, at the end of your time in India, you were accepted for pilot training. Could
yes.
you explain the circumstances of this?
Yes. Every 6 months or so, they call for volunteers amongst from the airmen for pilot flying training. And for this, the only qualification was, besides recommendation and general aptitude or sales discretion, etc., you had to be a leading aircraftsman or above, but it was very seldom right above corporal probably, but by the time you reach sergeant you're above the age limit, up to the age of 25, and you must be a leading aircraftsman, first rank. And I'd got my first class aircraftsman. I'd set the examination while at Ambala, and I passed it quite well, and from AC1, besides the rank, or the classification, wasn't a rank really, it's a classification of trade, and more pay, of course. And then I became in the Bar Northwest Frontier. I studied there for my leading aircraftsman, and I really was. I wanted to be a pilot. From the very beginning of this, that was my ambition. I wanted to be a pilot, and this was the opportunity, my ambition being fulfilled. And I really studied hard. I used to go, if I wasn't flying, I'd go in the afternoon, the hot Indian summer on the Northwest Frontier. Used to go in the reading room in the canteen of the reading room, and I used to go and sit there all alone. Nobody ever came in there of an afternoon. It's hot, and there were pictures of First World War flying aeroplanes in action. I used to look at these photographs and I'd get down my books and read, and eventually the examination came up. And I sat for it, written paper. Well, through my reading, I think, and my practical experience, I wrote as fast as I could, and I finished the exercise book they gave us for our answers. I finished that, I filled that, and I went on to the cover at the back, continued, and that was the written part. Some of it was quite difficult. Such the last question I did was the internal theory of a thermotic thermonic valve, how a valve worked, where the currents went, what sort of frequency you got inside of a valve. And I was working on this, drawing the diagrams, the graphs, and the frequencies on the voltages up and down, etc. I can't remember at all now, but now I drew these diagrams. And then when I do a practical test, your signals officer, or detail for the examination, examine one practical work, and with the flight sergeant in attendance, whilst operating the flight sergeant, or whilst mechanic. And soon I went in there, the officer said to me, he said, "Where do you get all your knowledge from for your paper?" I said, I had the Admiralty Handbook of Wireless Telegraphy. My brother sent to me from the Navy. The Air Force had one, but they're rather a very abridged copy of the Naval one. I studied it from the Naval book. And I said, from the Naval book of the Wireless Telegraphy and Telephony. And he said, "It's the best explanation I've ever seen of the working of a valve." I said, "I must congratulate you." And I thought, "This is good." And he said, "Well, paper's been marked up to 92%. I thought, "Well, that's a good start." And he said, "Well, practical work. What can I do with practical work? I know your squadron work." "You must know everything there is to know about practical work." I said, "Oh, I don't know." He said, "Well, connect that set up." It was an army cooperation set for sending signals. Well, that was easy enough. And he said, "Oh, well, you won't waste any more time. So you know all this stuff." And I think that's the only test I had. I didn't think of a Morse test or anything like that, or semaphore test. No, because I was an air gunner. No, I wasn't signals. It wasn't a signals test, it was an air gunner's test. And had to do a firing on the range, Lewis gun. Well, that was easy. I knew the Lewis gun inside out by this time. And that was all right. And I became a leading aircraftsman. And then, therefore, it immediately qualified me for time for a pilot's course. Next one that appeared on routine orders, volunteers required, I put my name in. And I heard nothing more. Wasn't even called to my CO for an interview because on the Northwest Frontier, probably too busy. And I thought, well, they got other people on the Northwest Frontier, they wouldn't bother. Anyway, I applied again, saw my squadron commander, and wondered how much flying I did and what I did in the squadron. Told my flying as an air gunner, wireless operator. An interview there, then interviewed the air officer commanding India, and he rather laughed at me when I appeared in front of him, one dressed in one's best drill, and the topi on helm, cork helmet, which made me 6'2" and another 5 or 6 inches on top, made me look a massive, I suppose. I walked in the door, gave a smart salute, and he said, ha ha ha! He said, oh, you're too tall, you put your head through the centre section. The centre section of a wing, he said, you put your head through the centre section. Oh, it's not a good start, but he's quite off. He's just a little crack to start off with. Anyway, we had a good chat, and but I didn't get it that time. And so next time, I again went through the whole procedure, application, so on, local medical examination, I did a local examination, medical officer, and my own commanding officer, then up to the air officer commanding India again. This time it was Sir Geoffrey Salmon, if you've heard of him, and then we had quite a usual long chat together. They could find out what you've been doing all your life, where you went to school, what you thought of service life, etc. And that time I was successful. Eventually I got the course, and it's the most amazing how I found out I'd got it. I was doing my fourth summer in India. I went to my hill station with the usual party, and I'd been there 2 or 3 days, and one of the regular wireless operators manning the ground station asked me if I could look around the wireless station. So